swearing on for the cabinet that I'll ask the president to dissolve the 32nd Dáil. I've always said that the election should happen at the best time for the country. Now is that time.
And therefore, if that is achieved, that you do have the possibility of creating greater growth in the society and creating better jobs.
Are we certain that we actually have the critical mass of public infrastructure and public service capacity to ensure that we can keep this golden goose that we have and that we can actually be the family that makes future generations better off?
Business at the ballot box. Be the voice.
Welcome back to Business at the Ballot Box, a daily general election podcast series brought to you by IBEC, the voice of Irish business. I'm Patrick Haughey, and in this episode, we explore the brave new world of work. In recent years, digital technologies, societal changes, legislation and regulation have completely transformed work and the labour market. Things like increased parental leave, flexible and remote working, the right to disconnect, changes to the retirement age, and many, many more. In this episode, we look at the many challenges that all of these present for Irish businesses and discuss how a new form of social dialogue can turn those challenges into opportunities. A little later, I will be meeting Margaret Cox of the ICE Group to talk about the impact the introduction of a four-day week has had on her company's productivity. But first, let's meet today's panel, comprised of Maeve McElwee, Director of Employer Relations at IBEC, and Michael Doherty, Professor of Law at Maynooth University. And Maeve McElwee begins by describing some of the more significant changes we have seen in the world of work in recent years.
IBEC, the voice of Irish business.
I think we've seen some really changed times from the very traditional world of work that we would have known up until recently. And I think we're seeing increasing digitalisation, we're seeing much more use of technology and the increasing use of artificial intelligence in the workplace. That's really changed how we interact with our labour market and how, I suppose, our jobs are evolving. So we see lots of people in jobs now that didn't exist, say, when I left school. And that's going to continue, but we think at an accelerating pace. And we'll see that redundancy come through in terms of, you know, older style types of work and forms of work. And as that changes and transitions, the importance is really going to be to upskill our labour force and make sure that we're ready for those transitions, but also that we have the flexibility within our labour force to be able to help people to transition from one role to another and maybe to make very big career changes mid-career in a way that we haven't traditionally seen. And I suppose what we would see over the years is some really significant shifts then in our society and how we engage at work and our expectations around work. So things like work-life balance, the importance of being able to take time out either for caring responsibilities, to go back to education, and how we connect. So even things like the mobile technology that we have and how regularly we connect in and out of our workplace on an ongoing basis. So all of those things impact on how we regulate and legislate for our employment relationships. And one of the big challenges that we've seen as IBEC has been the increasing, I suppose, creep of employment legislation, looking at all kinds of issues and areas which might actually be better dealt with through addressing company culture, that might be better addressed through codes of practice, where legislation can actually make that more restrictive and may ultimately leave us with challenges around how we embrace new technology, how we embrace things like platform working and gig working, remote and flexible working.
So, Michael Doherty, as the world of work, mainly driven through technology, is just rapidly, rapidly evolving, has legislation and the need to legislate around the new forms of work also had to really try and play catch up to a certain extent as well?
To a certain extent, Patrick, but I think Maeve makes a good point that we hear an awful lot about the rapidly changing nature of work and, you know, revolutionary changes and so on. It is important, I suppose, to realise that most people actually still do work a fairly traditional pattern. And that can be the difficulty in legislating, because you're trying, in terms of the evolving nature of work, you're trying to capture something that is definitely happening, but isn't the dominant or majority form of work at this time. So when you're legislating, you have to be careful that you're not putting the cart before the horse, essentially, that you're not trying to legislate for something that actually doesn't impact on the majority of people just yet. I mean, even if you take something like gig work and platform work, this is a really hot topic in my area in terms of academia, but also in terms of popular discourse and so on. But it's not really that new. I mean, we used to call it freelancing, essentially. And you know, a lot of the issues that come up in gig work and platform work and your Ubers and all this, we've seen in terms of, you know, journalists and musicians and so on for a long time. So a lot of the issues are not necessarily new. I think probably what is new is the technology and the impact of technology on our working lives. And that's really, I suppose, where we need to think very carefully about how we're going to regulate. And I think, in my view, there's probably been an overemphasis on the robots will take our jobs discourse. And, you know, what will happen when all these jobs disappear. And probably in Ireland, we haven't had enough of a debate about how employers and employees should manage the impact of technology on traditional or semi-traditional forms of employment. And maybe that's where we need to talk a little bit more in terms of how we do this into the future. To be honest, I think in Ireland we have, broadly speaking, quite a good legislative framework in employment. And I'm always a little sceptical about passing laws to deal with really specific issues, because then you hit the problem of you're passing a law which is a blunt instrument, which is difficult to change, you know, and could be in place for a longish time, even if it's not working. So I'm always a little bit sceptical about rushing to legislate on a specific issue that happens to be in, you know, the cultural consciousness at a particular time. I think we always need to think, particularly in employment, about, well, is this something actually that employers and employees should sort out for themselves? Do we need the state to pass a law, judges or adjudicators to be involved in that issue? And a lot of the issues around technological advance and work-life balance, there's a big cultural element there, and the law isn't always the best way to address cultural changes or to deal with cultural challenges.
How often are these laws that we're speaking about actually used, if used is the right word? I would imagine that a lot of these things are sorted out internally, like you say, from a cultural perspective, or conversations within the company. Are we seeing a lot of people using the law to address things like their right to disconnect, etc.?
Well, the Organisation Working Time Act is very well used in terms of people having access to the Workplace Relations Commission and having recourse to redress if they feel that in some way any aspect of that legislation has been breached. And that's been very successful in terms of dealing with those claims. So there are avenues where people feel that, you know, that they have been asked to work in excess of the normal hours. Nevertheless, what genuinely happens is most people sort it out among themselves. And as we, I suppose, as we embrace more technology and the ability to be able to work more remotely, that is something that culturally we're going to have to address as organisations. And we're seeing more and more organisations starting to look at best practice and principles as to how you deal with people who are working remotely and how you deal with that connectivity. So if you have somebody who's travelling for business and you're sitting in a hotel in, you know, the States or, you know, in the Far East, and you're sending emails because when you get home on Tuesday, you're going to want to spend that time with your family. The person who receives that email over the weekend should understand that there's no obligation outside of normal working hours, unless they're critical issues, and we all understand that, that, you know, there are norms and cultures around when you're expected to respond to those. And organisations really need to embed that in their own culture so that people have that understanding. There's lots of things about the tone of an email, you know, how you use the tone of that email to convey properly the urgency of
use
or
of
the
capitals.
Appropriateness. Use of capitals. Yes, courtesy and politeness. But it is also cultural, and people, you know, need some training and some guidelines around how that works. But also, I suppose, it's that clear understanding of what the expectation of you is. No piece of legislation is actually going to be able to set that beyond the underpinning legislation we already have.
Actually, but I have a good example of this. My email was hacked not so long ago, so all of my colleagues got what I considered a really rude email from me saying, "Hi, are you free? I need you now." And Some of them actually responded to that, and then the bot responded in turn, asking them to buy vouchers or something. It's quite, you know, it's getting more sophisticated all the time. But I mean, we did have a discussion about how I felt, you know, if you ever get an email from me that is so tonally inappropriate, you should first assume that it's not me, or secondly, that, you know, you need to tell me to, you know, where to go in terms of that request. So, you know, this thing about right to disconnect is a really good example, because there are laws in, most famously, I guess, in France, where, you know, employers have to do certain things to ensure people aren't working at certain times. There's also a law in France that there's a 35-hour working week, which we know the evidence shows is absolutely, you know, is enforced by a tiny proportion of firms. And this is the problem. Laws that don't make sense, or that people don't operate, or that really aren't enforceable, are worse than no laws at all, in my view, because they complicate the situation without achieving anything. Now, that's not, and on the other side, as Maeve has suggested, there are a number of really high profile companies like Volkswagen and so on, who have, you know, adopted their own internal organizational practices, like big multinational companies with thousands of workers, not governed by law, but governed by company practice. The problem can be, and I guess maybe I would think this is an issue in Ireland in particular, is that we don't have a very well established means of most businesses having consultation or negotiation with staff. It tends to happen on a fairly ad hoc basis. In other countries where, for example, trade unions would be stronger, or there would be other forms of employee representation, it might be easier to come to a solution to some of these things, because the Organization of Working Time Act is there, but it kind of relies on individual employees to take challenges, which in my view is never a good outcome, because it's difficult for employees to do so. Some employers might disagree with that, but that would be my view. And equally, it's kind of costly for employers, because you're fighting kind of individual issues all the time, or you're defending or having to justify individual issues rather than a more collective approach. So in my view, always, when you have issues like this one, which is really fundamentally about organizational culture and about how people interact with their employer, how employees interact with their employer, I think a negotiated solution is always better. But achieving that, I think, requires a bit of dialogue. I know earlier in the series you spoke about social dialogue, but even at the organizational level, I think better dialogue between management and staff could be a much better way to achieve a kind of reasonable outcome rather than passing a law.
Okay, stay with me, guys. I'd like to cut to a short interview I did with Margaret Cox, who's the managing director of the ICE Group, based primarily in Galway. Margaret's going to tell us a little bit about the company and working from Galway, but also they introduced a four-day week quite recently. Employees are paid for five, but they work four. And the ability for organisations to do that maybe is something that we could come back to after Margaret's interview. But first, let's hear Margaret Cox, ICE Group.
Business at the Ballot Box. Be the voice.
The ICE Group is a fantastic organisation. We recruit, we train, and we provide outsourced services to business in terms of HR. We have about 60 full-time people employed throughout Ireland. We have an agency workforce in excess of about 1,500 per week at peak times. And then we would be involved in training all along the Western region, in both public training for people who are unemployed, public training for people through the ETBs, and then corporate training directly for the private sector.
Obviously, Galway has so much to offer, but I guess, and you will see it as a business person there, it's also got so much potential and so much more that could be sort of developed there, and so much more potential to reach. So in terms of what government, the next government could do to help Galway reach even more of its potential, what would come to mind?
It's very simple. We need, we talk about journey certainty in relation to motorway traffic. or motorway travel. We need to know that when we're going to work, it's going to take us 20 minutes or 40 minutes or 50 minutes so that we can get home in time to pick up kids from daycare or whatever it is that we're doing. We need certainty in our health system in terms of understanding if I go to hospital, I'm going to have a bed. I'm not going to sit in A&E for 60 and 70 hours at a time. That's not acceptable. So it's infrastructural investment in housing, transport and health. That's what we need. Basically, we should be the Silicon Valley of Ireland. That's what we should be. That's our focus. And we're well positioned to do that. As I mentioned, the connectivity earlier on, the accessibility, it's really, really easy to work in and around Galway. And that's our opportunity. That's our unique selling point. We're on the west of Ireland, next stop America, and we're there, a direct gateway into Europe. So we would be hoping that we would see more balanced development in the west of Ireland and that it wouldn't be just spread in the city, but all the way from Clifton down to Limerick, from, you know, the top of Mayo, indeed, even down to Limerick. That's the type of thing we'd like to see.
And speaking of workforces, you've done something very interesting, the ICE Group, and it's all around a four-day week. What did you do? What is it all about?
You know, our four-day week... ICE is the home of the 3-day weekend, 4-day week and 5 days pay. And it's as simple as that. So what we have done is we've created an opportunity for our employees to work for 4 days, get paid for 5 days, and we've maintained our productivity. Indeed, we've increased our productivity.
Really?
27% increase in productivity in our trial period. And we're very proud of that. We're passionate about the 4-day week.
What does it look like? Do the doors of the office shut on, you know, close a business on Thursday and that's it? Or are people encouraged to take it, but maybe they have some work five or...
So our model is very simple. As I said, the 3-day weekend. So your week looks like work Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, off Friday, Saturday, Sunday, or you work Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and you're off Saturday, Sunday, Monday. So the office is still open 5 days a week. We're actually open 10 more hours each week now for our clients than we were before this, because we've changed the opening hours to try and make sure that we get the work done. And I'll tell you what the office looks like. It looks like happy. It's everybody is delighted. They come in. It's coming back to work after a bank holiday weekend. But, you know, you don't have to wait for the next one to come because you have a bank holiday weekend every single week.
Business at the Ballot Box. Be the voice.
Margaret Cox there, Managing Director of the ICE Group. And Maeve McElwee, Director of Employer Relations at IBEC. Really, really interesting to hear how they have introduced the 4-day week and obviously working very well for the ICE Group. But is it something that everybody can offer, or does that provide challenges to a lot of companies?
Yeah, I think it's probably one option of flexibility that for some organisations it may work very well and it may fit in with you know, how they operate and the type of staffing environment that they have. It's probably just one of many options that employers will look at. And in some ways it's nearly old-fashioned in that it's just one day less than we're doing now. It's not really very innovative and won't work for lots of the demands that employers see coming through now, which is much more nuanced in terms of the flexibility that people are looking for. So, you know, people are looking for not necessarily one additional day, but it's more flex around the hours that they're working, the times that they're working. It's to accommodate other family responsibilities. And one additional day off doesn't deal with the fact that you need to pick up from the creche at a certain time, maybe on another day of the week. So for some, it will be great. For other organisations who've tried it, and we've seen that some have tried it, like the Wellcome Trust in the UK and some US tech companies, have said for various reasons, such as the complexity of trying to manage people working across the working week on 4-day weeks, just had become excessive and uncompetitive. Others who had said they had fallen behind their competitors effectively, that it just wasn't making economic sense for them. And we know that some of the Swedish trials around nursing and elder care was very, very expensive. And it's the challenge of being able to also find people to replace. If everybody is working a 4-day working week, then you're going to need to hire additional staff to be able to keep your business operating at the same level, and particularly in a service environment, to be able to service the needs of your customers or your service users to the same level. And that's challenging. And that kind of leads me on to some of the other issues that we've seen in terms of employment regulation this year, because one that really strikes me is the whole area of parental leave and paternity leave and the Parents Leave and Benefit Act that have all come through very recently.
And this is where you don't have a choice to offer the flexibility. This is where you have to offer.
Exactly. Yeah. So this is statutory leave, most of it directed towards parents of children under the age of one in terms of the more recent leave, but for parents in general. Now, just to be clear, it's great to see some of this leave coming through. It's great to be able to offer more flexibility. And certainly from my perspective, when we look at increasing parents' leave and parental leave, the opportunity for balancing those gender traditional roles is great. And it's a small step towards that gender pay gap closure, hopefully over time. But I think we also need to recognise the challenges for businesses, and particularly in a full employment economy. So if you have to release people for periods of time, and particularly where people are released in short blocks of time, that's hugely challenging for businesses to replace. So if you consider that most of the private sector in Ireland is made up of businesses that are quite small in nature, if you lose somebody, or I shouldn't say lose, if somebody in a critical service role to your business is taking time on a statutory period of leave and you need to backfill that, there's challenges in terms of the recruitment cost, the training cost, the lost productivity as you train somebody in, and even just the availability of staff. So maybe you're having to spread that work across your existing workforce, and that in itself creates a pressure. It also creates a pressure where perhaps you're having to refuse other people leave or opportunities to go and study or to engage in sporting activities, for example, because you have others in one cohort who have significant periods of statutory leave. And that's something that as we see people working longer and we see more requirements for people to balance that whole work life in a way that we didn't see in traditional employments, that's becoming more challenging and very particularly for smaller businesses to be able to absorb. We also need to think very carefully about the context in which we do legislate, because, you know, as we've already talked about, how we work is changing and the jobs that we do are also changing very considerably. One of the things we were enormously disappointed in this year or last year when the Parents Leave Bill was introduced was that the minister refused an amendment that had been proposed that would allow employers to put somebody returning from a period of parents' leave into a suitable alternative role in the event that their job had was no longer in existence when they were returning. Now, bearing in mind that this already exists in our current maternity legislation, it's already in our parental leave legislation, with no evidence that it has been abused in any way. But the reality is that, you know, lots of people will take parents' leave potentially at the end of a period of maternity leave, an additional maternity leave. And so people may be missing for a very significant period of time. We know that contracts change. We know that businesses change hands. We know that, you know, departments increase and decrease and roles will change over that period of time. To develop a piece of legislation that entitles somebody to take leave, but immediately potentially puts an employer in direct conflict where they may breach that legislation technically, is really poor legislative development. We're continuing to lobby to have that amended and returned to the situation we see in the maternity and parental leave legislation. But it is going to have to be a consideration into the longer term. We do have to recognise that business has to have that flexibility to change. We can't have a situation where people are coming back to jobs that no longer exist in businesses or business segments of businesses that may no longer be operating.
But if that clause wasn't in the maternity leave legislation, then why was it suddenly introduced more recently in this particular kind of leave? What's driving that?
Well, I think our feeling is very much that there's this very negative narrative in the media around big employer, individual, and I suppose the potential for employers to abuse their power in this circumstance. Now, we've not seen any evidence of that in all of the years that the maternity and parental leave legislation has been in place. There are very robust structures within the WRC that would allow the Workplace Relations Commission that allow people to challenge if they feel they haven't been fairly treated on return from any protective leave. And it seems really just to be this whole, well, bad employers will abuse it. And that's a very negative message to send as well.
Michael, just coming back to this, the right to disconnect that we spoke about earlier, it seems that big employer needs to become big brother to a certain extent in monitoring this. This is going to cause incredible complexities.
Yes, so there's a flip side of the cultural change I spoke about earlier, where people want to, you know, have work-life balance. people with technology are more, you know, you can do a little bit of work at 7 o'clock in the evening if you have, you know, taken the morning to drop the kids to school or something like that. That's what people want. And by and large, employers will facilitate that, you know, because it's usually a win-win. But there's a kind of fundamental contradiction, or tension, I guess is a better word, in that employers, we know, increasingly have an obligation to ensure that people aren't working excessively. And we've had some high profile decisions in Ireland on that. But on the other side, employers have an obligation and a duty not to interfere over much with the privacy of their employees. And here is where you have an absolute tension. What technology enables employers to do is to monitor probably better how long people are working. If you know, you see how many emails somebody sends, you see the period they're sent, so the employer has a good idea of how long that person was working. Equally though, that employee could quite literally be lying in his or her bedroom with the mobile phone out, email in one tab, Netflix on the other, you know, watching, well, you wouldn't watch Love Island on Netflix, but you know, you'd watch on another network. And so, you know, if we're asking the employer to monitor that activity, we are asking the employer quite literally to monitor what somebody is doing in the privacy of their own bedroom. So that is a real challenge. Where does the line between monitoring for legitimate purposes to ensure that there's no overwork going on versus monitoring for illegitimate, or what the courts would say would be illegitimate, interfering in someone's privacy, where is that line drawn? And again, that's why sometimes legislation can be a little bit of a blunt tool there, because it's not easy to capture in an act or statute, you know, the nuances and complexities of that. It's a really difficult, I can see certainly more cases coming down the tracks, you know, where on both sides of that line from employees.
And I think the one big thing coming out of this conversation is that the nuances and complexities are the real thing in this issue. There is very little black and white, which I guess, Maeve, means that the only way through nuances and complexities is probably dialogue and actually getting everyone around the table to thrash it out.
Yeah, absolutely. And I know Danny McCoy has addressed this in some of our earlier podcasts. It's that whole area of social dialogue, and across lots of areas of labour market legislation, the need for an increased and more formalised social dialogue engagement really is, I suppose, becoming more relevant now as we see the world of work change, and the importance of being able to have clear understandings of how we deal with some of these issues rather than the blunt instrument of simply legislating with all of the unintended consequences that come with that. And I guess, you know, there are other big issues that we're seeing currently that again would benefit very greatly from more social dialogue. Things like the retirement age that we've seen blow up in the course of this general election piece, and the challenges that we're starting to see. And there are two separate issues in this almost. One is the pension age and the age of attaining state pension, which is increasing, and how we then deal with retirement age. And for employers, that whole question of being able to maintain a mandatory retirement age to give you that certainty as to when people are going to retire out of the business. We have been speaking with the various government departments to try and bring together some thinking around retirement age. For employers, the issue of certainty is really what it's all about. EU law and Irish legislation permits us to set mandatory retirement ages in people's contracts. And that's really important for business because it gives us that certainty of when people are moving through our business. It allows us that opportunity to do succession planning. It allows us the opportunity to be able to invest in training, to be able to identify opportunities for people in their careers. But importantly, it also offers us that opportunity to be able to look at diversity and inclusion, to be able to hire people that reflect some of the changes in Irish society, to be able to look at issues around gender pay gap, because we have some certainty as to when people are moving through our organisations. The challenge of some of the legislation that's being proposed out there, or the promises that are being made in the campaigns of removing mandatory retirement age, leaves organisations wide open to all kinds of risk, as well as you know, challenges to all of the investment that they want to make. What employers are saying to us is, actually, they're not all that concerned about what retirement age is set. If it was realigned to state pension age, that would be fine. But what we actually need as businesses is the certainty that says, if we realign, have we got some security that that would be accepted as an objective justification, having made the move in the first instance? And how can we do that? So there are the various different options that we have been talking about around post-retirement fixed-term contracts and the ability to be able to offer those without some of the restrictions government has put on them more recently, or the ability to use maybe the codes of practice to realign to state retirement age and still maintain that certainty.
Michael?
Yeah, I think the issue of pension ages and retirement ages have come up in the election, to my mind, in a really confused way. It's almost a scattergun kind of approach. You know, on one hand, you hear a lot of vox pops of people saying, well, I've worked 50 years and, you know, it's a hard job and I want to retire. On the other hand, a lot of, from my kind of side of things, a lot of the case law is about people who don't want to retire and who want to continue on are being forced to retire. And then into the mix, you get the situation with pensions where people are forced to retire mandatorily but are not entitled because the state pension age has been moved. So there's a real issue, and we've mentioned it a couple of times, but there is a real issue here about joined up thinking. And again, the problem of legislating for things in isolation leads often to unintended consequences. So you've almost had a development on mandatory retirement ages on one track where legislation and court case law has happened, and then pensions on a separate track. And what we really need, obviously, is to integrate those two things. I think that there have been a number of kind of high profile decisions on the mandatory retirement age, which I feel throw up a lot of issues, which we do need to confront, because I think there is a need for employers to have the capability to set a mandatory retirement age. As Maeve said, that can be negotiated. It can be set out. It can be agreed with employees. Again, what the legislation says is you can do it. You just have to be careful as to how you do it. So I think trying again to set legislative limits around this is probably not a good idea, but we are, due to some kind of dicta in courts and so on, we're a little bit unsure as to what we can do. I think that should definitely be addressed, again, not necessarily in legislation, but maybe by a more joined up policy think about the interaction between retirement and pension ages.
And essentially, Maeve, just to wrap up, what you've been getting throughout this conversation is that representative groups such as IBEC, individual companies, are putting forward solutions. There are ideas around how we can get around the challenges, and some of the complexities are being thrown up here. There just needs to be an ear for those solutions.
Absolutely. So we have made a number of proposals around how we might be able to accommodate, you know, the richness of the experience and the talent of older workers within our organisations to address some of the challenges of the gap with state pension age. But we actually need some support at a government level to be able to ensure that we can get that over the line and have that certainty.
IBEC, the voice of Irish business.
And that was Maeve McElwee, Director of Employer Relations at IBEC, and Michael Doherty, Professor of Law at Maynooth University. Before we wrap up today's episode, we're going to meet John Keeney, CEO of a company called Syro, and who's also chair of the IBEC representative body, Telecommunications Industry Ireland, to hear about his vision for telecommunications in Ireland and what the next government needs to prioritise to make that happen.
So Syro is a company established to roll out a 100% fibre broadband network. We are working across regional Ireland. At this point, we've passed over 300,000 homes and businesses, and we have more than 56,000 homes connected to our network. The value of fibre is that it is a future-proof technology. So it is hard to roll out, but once it's rolled out, it's there for the future. So today you can get speeds of 1 gig, but in the future that can grow. But it's also reliable and it's secure in terms of its delivery. So our operational rates are in the five nines, as my operations director would tell me. I think our objective, and I think the objective for Ireland needs to be that over the next 4 to 5 years, all of Ireland is covered with fibre.
Yeah.
And that enables Ireland to really embrace the digital economy and really set ourselves up for the future. It's an investment in our future.
What do you need from government, from the next government, to support that ambition?
I think what you need from the next government is to, I think they almost need to step forward in time. So we've just entered the 2020s, so it's January 2020. I think they need to look at, in January 2030, what do they want Ireland to look like? And I think then policy and decisions should be made with that time frame, not the next 2 weeks or 3 weeks or what wins votes. So then if you think about that, it is from a telecoms perspective and from a societal perspective, in enabling infrastructure investment in telecoms enables the future. They are the highways of the future. So where we have, and that is across not just what we're doing in CSIRO, it is across 5G rollout, and it's across the Internet of Things and support the investment there. So there is a bit of a pushback in certain areas of Ireland at the moment on 5G investment, and you've got local councils, local groups putting up barriers. And those need to be addressed. I mean, from the short term, they need to be addressed because they support the long term for what Ireland can become. Again, if I think forward 10 years, what we need is to deal with climate change. We need to have policies that address that. We need policies that address how we commute. I think, but strong telecoms infrastructure plays a huge part in that. So working from home becomes the norm or very easy. That stops long commutes. Where people are paying for childcare from 7:30 in the morning till 7:30 at night. It supports inclusion, actually. So the digital society, people can then enabling them to work from home or different areas means that if transport isn't quite right, that no longer becomes a problem. So I would say it's looking, what does the next 10 years need to look like? And then the next government need to set policy and set in train decisions that allow us to become what we can become.
John Keeney, CEO of CSIRO and chair of the IBEC representative body, Telecommunications Industry Ireland there. That's it for today's episode. Thanks for tuning in, and please do check out previous episodes of Business at the Ballot Box for a really comprehensive look at how we can shape a better business landscape and society in Ireland, as told by Ireland's business leaders, campaigners and policy experts. Join the conversation on Twitter and LinkedIn using the hashtag #BeTheVoice, and also check out our short video clips from the series on the same channels, and you will find lots more information by visiting ibec.ie. Thanks again, and we'll catch you next time.
Business at the Ballot Box. Be the voice.